catch and then throw down on him. Make him lie face down, wait for the cops. That's it. Do it. He's turning around. Here's the number, he said. He had a business card. Take it? No. Good. Thank you. Mr. Gordon, do you have a telephone I could use? As he put the card on the table, the moth flew. It came from behind him, past his head, and lit between them on a cabinet above the sink. He looked at it. When she didn't look at it, when her eyes never left his face, he knew. Their eyes met, and they knew each other. Mr. Gum tilted his head a little to the side. He smiled. "I have a cordless phone in the pantry. I'll get it for you." "No, do it." She went for the gun. One smooth move she'd done 4,000 times, and it was right where it was supposed to be. Good two-hand hold. Her whirled the front sight in the center of his chest. "Freeze!" He pursed his lips. "Now, slowly, put up your hands. Move him outside, keep the table between us. Walk him to the front, face down in the middle of the street, and hold up the badge. Mr. Gum, you're under arrest. I want you to walk slowly outside for me." Instead, he walked out of the room. If he had reached for his pocket, reached behind him, if she'd seen a weapon she could have fired, he just walked out of the room. She heard him, down the basement stairs, fast, she around the table and to the door at the top of the stairwell. He was gone, the stairwell brightly lit and empty. Trap! Be a sitting duck on the stairs. From the basement, then, a thin paper cut of a scream. She didn't like the stairs. Didn't like the stairs, Clarice Starling in the quick where you give it or you don't. Catherine Martin screamed again, "He's killing her," and Starling went down them anyway, one hand on the banister, gun arm out, the gun just under her line of vision, floor below bounding over the gun sight, gun arm swinging with her head as she tried to cover the two facing doors open at the bottom of the staircase. Lights blazing in the basement. She couldn't go through one door without turning her back on the other. Do it quick, then, to the left toward the scream, into the sand-floored oubliette room, clearing the door frame fast, eyes wider than they had ever been. Only place to hide was behind the well, she sliding sideways around the wall, both hands on the gun, arms out straight, a little pressure on the trigger, on around the well and nobody behind it. A small scream rising from the well like thin smoke. Yipping now, a dog. She approached the well, eyes on the door, got to the rim, looked over the edge, saw the girl, looked up again, down again, said what she was trained to say, calm the hostage. "FBI, you're safe." "Safe, shit! He's got a gun! Get me out! Get me out!" "Catherine, you'll be all right. Shut up. Do you know where he is?" "Get me out! I don't give a shit where he is! Get me out!" "I'll get you out. Be quiet. Help me. Be quiet so I can hear. Try and shut that dog up." Braced behind the well, covering the door, her heart pounded, and her breath blew dust off the stone. She could not leave Catherine Martin to get help when she didn't know where Gum was. She moved up to the door and took cover behind the frame. She could see across the foot of the stairs and into part of the workroom beyond. Either she found Gum, or she made sure he'd fled, or she took Catherine out with her. Those were the only choices. A quick look over her shoulder, around the oubliette room. Catherine, is there a ladder?
I don't know. I woke up down here. He let the bucket down on strings.
Bolted to a wall beam was a small hand winch. There was no line on the drum of the winch.
Catherine, I have to find something to get you out with. Can you walk?
Yes. Don't leave me.
I have to leave the room for just a minute.
You fucking bitch, don't leave me down here. My mother will tear your goddamn shit brains out.
Catherine, shut up. I want you to be quiet so I can hear. To save yourself, be quiet. Do you understand?
Then louder.
The other officers will be here any minute. Now shut up. We won't leave you down there.
He had to have a rope. Where was it? Go see. Starling moved across the stairwell in one rush to the door of the workroom. Door's the worst place. In fast, back and forth along the near wall, until she had seen all the room, familiar shapes swimming in the glass tanks, she too alert to be startled. Quickly through the room, past the tanks, the sinks, past the cage, a few big moths flying, she ignored them. Approaching the corridor beyond, it blazing with light, The refrigerator turned on behind her, and she spun in a crouch, hammer lifting off the frame of the Magnum, eased the pressure off. On to the corridor. She wasn't taught to peek. Head and gun at once, but low. The corridor empty. The studio blazing with light at the end of it. Fast along it, gambling past the closed door, onto the studio door. The room all white and blonde oak. Hell to clear from the doorway. Make sure every mannequin is a mannequin, every reflection is a mannequin. Only movement in the mirrors your movement. The great armoire stood open and empty. The far door open onto darkness, the basement beyond. No rope, no ladder anywhere. No lights beyond the studio. She closed the door into the dark part of the basement, pushed a chair under the knob, and pushed a sewing machine against it. If she could be positive he wasn't in this part of the basement, she'd risk going upstairs for a moment to find a phone. Back down the corridor, one door she'd passed, get on the side opposite the hinges, all the way open in one move. The door slammed back, nobody behind it. An old bathroom. In it, rope, hooks, a sling. Get Catherine or go for the phone? In the bottom of the well, Catherine wouldn't get shot by accident. But if Starling got killed, Catherine was dead too. Take Catherine with her to the phone. Starling didn't want to stay in the bathroom long. He could come to the door and hose her. She looked both ways and ducked inside for the rope. There was a big bathtub in the room. The tub was almost filled with hard red-purple plaster. A hand and wrist stuck up from the plaster. The hand turned dark and shriveled, the fingernails painted pink. On the wrist was a dainty watch. Starling was seeing everything at once, the rope, the tub, the hand, the watch. The tiny insect crawl of the second hand was the last thing she saw before the lights went out. Her heart knocked hard enough to shake her chest and arms. Dizzy, dark. Need to touch something. The edge of the tub. The bathroom. Get out of the bathroom. If he can find the door, he can hose this room. Nothing to get behind. Oh, dear Jesus, go out. Go out. Down, low, and out in the hall. Every light out? Every light. He must have done it at the fuse box. Pulled the lever. Where would it be? Where would the fuse box be? Near the stairs. Lots of times near the stairs. If it is, he'll come from that way. But he's between me and Catherine. Catherine Martin was keening again. Wait here? Wait forever? Maybe he's gone. He can't be sure no backup's coming. Yes, he can. But soon I'll be missed. Tonight. The stairs are in the direction of the screams. Solve it, now. She moved quietly, her shoulder barely brushing the wall, brushing it too lightly for sound, one hand extended ahead, the gun at waist level, close to her in the confined hallway. Out into the workroom now. Feel the space opening up. Open room. In the crouch in the open room, arms out, both hands on the gun. You know exactly where the gun is. It's just below eye level. Stop. Listen. Head and body and arms turning together like a turret. Stop. Listen. In absolute black, the hiss of steam pipes, trickle of water. Heavy in her nostrils, the smell of the goat. Catherine Keening. Against the wall stood Mr. Gum, with his goggles on. There was no danger she'd bump into him. There was an equipment table between them. He played his infrared light up and down her. She was too slender to be of great utility to him. He remembered her hair, though, from the kitchen, and it was glorious. And that would only take a minute. He could slip it right off, put it on himself. He could lean over the well wearing it and tell that thing, "Surprise!" It was fun to watch her trying to sneak along. She had her hip against the sinks now, creeping toward the screams with her gun stuck out. It would have been fun to hunt her for a long time. He'd never hunted one armed before. He would have thoroughly enjoyed it. No time for that. Pity. A shot in the face would be fine and easy at 8 feet. Now. He cocked the python as he brought it up, snick, snick, and the figure blurred, bloomed green in his vision, and his gun bucked in his right hand, and the floor hit him hard in the back, and his light was on, and he saw the ceiling, Starling on the floor, flash blind, ears ringing, deafened by the blast of the guns.
She worked in the dark while neither could hear, dump the empties, tip it, feel to see they're all out, in with the speed loader, feel it, tip it down, twist, drop it, close the cylinder. She fired four, two shots and two shots. He'd fired once. She found the two good cartridges she'd dumped. Put them where? In the speed loader pouch. She lay still. Move before he can hear? The sound of a revolver being cocked is like no other. She'd fired at the sound, seen nothing past the great muzzle flashes of the guns. She hoped he'd fire now in the wrong direction, give her the muzzle flash to shoot at. Her hearing was coming back. Her ears still rang, but she could hear. What was that sound? Whistling? Like a tea kettle, but interrupted. What was it? Like breathing. Is it me? No. Her breath blew warm off the floor, back in her face. Careful, don't get dust, don't sneeze. It's breathing. It's a sucking chest wound. He's hit in the chest. They'd taught her how to seal one, to put something over it, a rain slicker, a plastic bag, something airtight, strap it tight, reinflate the lung. She'd hit him in the chest then. What to do? Wait. Let him stiffen up and bleed. Wait. Starling's cheek stung. She didn't touch it. If it was bleeding, she didn't want her hands slick. The moaning from the well came again. Catherine talking, crying. Starling had to wait. She couldn't answer Catherine. She couldn't say anything or move. Mr. Gum's invisible light played on the ceiling. He tried to move it, and he couldn't, any more than he could move his head. A great Malaysian luna moth passing close beneath the ceiling picked up the infrared and came down, circled, lit on the light. The pulsing shadows of its wings, enormous on the ceiling, were visible only to Mr. Gum. Over the sucking in the dark, Starling heard Mr. Gum's ghastly voice, choking.
How does it feel to be so beautiful?
And then another sound, a gurgle, a rattle, and the whistling stopped. Starling knew that sound too. She'd heard it once before, at the hospital when her father died. She felt for the edge of the table and got to her feet. Feeling her way along, going toward the sounds of Catherine, she found the stairwell and climbed the stairs in the dark. It seemed to take a long time. There was a candle in the kitchen drawer. With it she found the fuse box beside the stairs, jumped when the lights came on. To get to the fuse box and shut off the lights, he must have left the basement another way and come down again behind her. Starling had to be positive he was dead. She waited until her eyes were well adjusted to the light before she went back in the workroom, and then she was careful. She could see his naked feet and legs sticking out from under the work table. She kept her eyes on the hand beside the gun until she kicked the gun away. His eyes were open. He was dead, shot through the right side of the chest, thick blood under him. He had put on some of his things from the armoire, and she couldn't look at him long. She went to the sink, put the Magnum on the drain board, and ran cold water on her wrists, wiped her face with her wet hand. No blood. Moths batted at the mesh around the lights. She had to step around the body to retrieve the python. At the well, she said, "Catherine, he's dead. He can't hurt you. I'm going upstairs and call..."
"No! Get me out! Get me out! Get me out!"
"Look here. He's dead. This is his gun. Remember it? I'm going to call the police and the fire department. I'm afraid to hoist you out myself. You might fall. Soon as I call them, I'll come back down and wait with you. Okay? Okay. Try to shut that dog up. Okay? Okay." The local television crews arrived just after the fire department and before the Belvedere police. The fire captain, angered at the glare from the lights, drove the television crews back up the stairs and out of the basement, while he rigged a pipe frame to hoist out Catherine Martin, not trusting Mr. Gum's hook in the ceiling joist. The fireman went down into the well and put her in the rescue chair. Catherine came out holding the dog, kept the dog in the ambulance. They drew the line on dogs at the hospital and wouldn't let the dog in. A fireman instructed to drop it off at the animal shelter,
took it home with him instead. Chapter 57. There were about 50 people at National Airport in Washington meeting the red-eye flight from Columbus, Ohio. Most of them were meeting relatives, and they looked sleepy and grumpy enough, with their shirt-tails sticking out below their jackets. From the crowd, Ardelia Mapp had a chance to look Starling over as she came off the plane. Starling was pasty, dark under the eyes. Some black grains of gunpowder were in her cheek. Starling spotted Mapp, and they hugged. "Hey, sport," Mapp said. "You check anything?" Starling shook her head. "Jeff's outside in the van. Let's go home." Jack Crawford was outside, too, his car parked behind the van in the limousine lane. He'd had Bella's relatives all night. He started. "You know what you did. You hit a home run, kid." He touched her cheek. "What's this?" "Burnt gunpowder. The doctor said it'll work out by itself in a couple of days. Better than digging for it." Crawford took her to him and held her very tight for a moment, just a moment, and then put her away from him and kissed her on the forehead. "You know what you did," he said again. "Go home. Go to sleep. Sleep in. I'll talk to you tomorrow." The new surveillance van was comfortable, designed for long stakeouts. Starling and Mapp rode in the big chairs in the back. Without Jack Crawford in the van, Jeff drove a little harder. They made good time toward Quantico. Starling rode with her eyes closed. After a couple of miles, Mapp nudged her knee. Mapp had opened two short-bottle Cokes. She handed Starling a Coke and took a half pint of Jack Daniels out of her purse. They each took a swig out of their Cokes and poured in a shot of sour mash. Then they stuck their thumbs in the necks of the bottles, shook them, and shot the foam in their mouths. "Ah," Starling said. "Don't spill that in here," Jeff said.
"Don't worry, Jeff," Mapp said, quietly to Starling. "You should have seen my man Jeff waiting for me outside the liquor store. He looked like he was passing peach seeds."
When Mapp saw the whiskey start to work a little, when Starling sank a little deeper in her chair, Mapp said, "How you doing, Starling?"
"Ardelia, I'm damned if I know."
"You don't have to go back, do you?"
"Maybe for one day next week, but I hope not. The U.S. attorney came over from Columbus to talk to the Belvedere cops. I did depositions out the wazoo."
"Couple of good things," Mapp said. "Senator Martin's been on the phone all evening from Bethesda. You knew they took Catherine to Bethesda. Well, she's okay. He didn't mess her up in any physical way. Emotional damage, they don't know. They have to watch." "Don't worry about school. Crawford and Brigham both called. The hearing's canceled. Crendler asked for his memo back. These people have got a heart like a greasy BB, Starling. You get no slack. You don't have to take the search and seizure exam at 0800 tomorrow, but you take it Monday, and the PE test right after. We'll jam over the weekend." They finished the half pint just north of Quantico and dumped the evidence in a barrel at a roadside park. "That Pilcher, Dr. Pilcher at the Smithsonian, called three times. Made me promise to tell you he called. He's not a doctor. You think you might do something about him?" "Maybe. I don't know yet."
"He sounds like he's pretty funny."
"I've about decided funny's the best thing in men. I'm talking about aside from money and your basic manageability."
"Yeah, and manners, too. You can't leave that out."
"Right. Give me a son of a bitch with some manners every time."
Starling went like a zombie from the shower to the bed. Mapp kept her reading light on for a while until Starling's breathing was regular. Starling jerked in her sleep. A muscle in her cheek twitched, and once her eyes opened wide. Mapp woke sometime before daylight, the room feeling empty. Mapp turned on her light. Starling was not in her bed. Both of their laundry bags were missing, so Mapp knew where to look. She found Starling in the warm laundry room, dozing against the slow rump-rump of a washing machine in the smell of bleach and soap and fabric softener. Starling had the psychology background, Mapp's was law, yet it was Mapp who knew that the washing machine's rhythm was like a great heartbeat, and the rush of its waters was what the unborn hear, our last memory of peace.
Chapter 58.
Jack Crawford woke early on the sofa in his study and heard the snoring of his in-laws in his house. In the free moment before the weight of the day came on him, he remembered not Bella's death, but the last thing she'd said to him, her eyes clear and calm. "What's going on in the yard?" He took Bella's grain scoop and, in his bathrobe, went out and fed the birds as he had promised to do. Leaving a note for his sleeping in-laws, he eased out of the house before sunrise. Crawford had always gotten along with Bella's relatives, more or less, and it helped to have the noise in the house. But he was glad to get away to Quantico. He was going through the overnight telex traffic and watching the early news in his office when Starling pressed her nose to the glass of the door. He dumped some reports out of a chair for her, and they watched the news together without saying anything. Here it came. The outside of James Gumm's old building in Belvedere, with its empty storefront and soaked windows covered with heavy gates. Starling hardly recognized it. "Dungeon of Horrors," the newsreader called it. Harsh, jostled pictures of the well and the basement, still cameras held up before the television camera, an angry fireman waving the photographers back, moths crazed by the television lights flying into the lights, a moth on the floor on its back, wings beating down to a final tremor, Catherine Martin refusing a stretcher and walking to the ambulance with a policeman's coat around her, the dog sticking its face out between the lapels. A side view of Starling walking fast to a car, her head down, hands in the pockets of her coat. The film was edited to exclude some of the more grisly objects. In the far reaches of the basement, the cameras could show only the low, lime-sprinkled thresholds of the chambers holding Gumm's tableaus. The body count in that part of the basement stood at 6 so far. Twice Crawford heard Starling expel air through her nose. The news went to a commercial break. "Good morning, Starling." "Hello," she said, as though it were later in the day. "The U.S. attorney in Columbus faxed me your depositions overnight. You'll have to sign some copies for him." "So you went from Frederica Bimmel's house to Stacy Hubka and then to the Burdeen woman at the store Bimmel sewed for, Richards Fashions, and Mrs. Burdeen gave you Mrs. Lippman's old address, the building there." Starling nodded. Stacy Hubka had been by the place a couple of times to pick up Frederica, but Stacy's boyfriend was driving and her directions were vague. Mrs. Burdeen had the address. "Mrs. Burdeen never mentioned a man at Mrs. Lippman's?" "No." The television news had filmed from Bethesda Naval Hospital Senator Ruth Martin's face framed in a limousine window. "Catherine was rational last night, yes. She's sleeping. She's sedated right now. We're counting our blessings. No, as I said before, she's suffering from shock, but she's rational, just bruises and her fingers broken. And she's dehydrated as well, thank you." She poked her chauffeur in the back. "Thank you. No, she mentioned the dog to me last night. I don't know what we'll do about it. We already have 2 dogs." The story closed with a nothing quote from a stress specialist who would be talking with Catherine Martin later in the day to assess emotional damage. Crawford shut it off. "How you hitting him, Starling?" "Kind of numb. You too?" Crawford nodded, quickly moved along. "Senator Martin's been on the phone overnight. She wants to come see you. Catherine does, too, as soon as she can travel." "I'm always home." "Krendler, too. He wants to come down here. He asked for his memo back." "Come to think of it, I'm not always home." "Here's some free advice. Use Senator Martin. Let her tell you how grateful she is. Let her hand you the markers. Do it soon. Gratitude has a short half-life. You'll need her one of these days, the way you act." "That's what Ardelia says." "Your roomie, Map? The superintendent told me Map's set to cram you for your makeup exams on Monday. She just pulled a point and a half ahead of her arch-rival Stringfellow, he tells me."
"For valedictorian?"
"He's tough, though, Stringfellow. He's saying she can't hold him off." "He best bring his lunch." In the clutter on Crawford's desk was the origami chicken Dr. Lecter had folded. Crawford worked the tail up and down. The chicken pecked. "Lecter's gone platinum. He's at the top of everybody's most wanted list," he said. Still, he could be out for a while. Off the post, you need some good habits. She nodded. He's busy now, Crawford said, but when he's not busy, he'll entertain himself. We need to be clear on this. You know he'd do it to you, just like he'd do anybody else.
I don't think he'd ever bushwhack me. It's rude. And he wouldn't get to ask any questions that way. Sure, he'd do it as soon as I board him.
Maintain good habits, is all I'm saying. When you go off the post, flag your 3-card. No phone queries on your whereabouts without positive ID. I want to put a trace alert on your telephone if you don't mind. It'll be private unless you push the button.
I don't look for him to come after me, Mr. Crawford.
But you heard what I said.
I did hear.
Take these depositions and look them over. Add if you want to. We'll witness your signatures here when you're ready. Starling, I'm proud of you. So is Brigham. So is the director.
It sounded stiff, not like he wanted it to sound.
He went to his office door. She was going away from him, down the deserted hall. He managed to hail her from his burg of grief. Starling, your father sees you.
Chapter 59.
Jame Gumm was news for weeks after he was lowered into his final hole. Reporters pieced together his history, beginning with the records of Sacramento County. His mother had been carrying him a month when she failed to place in the Miss Sacramento contest in 1948. The Jame on his birth certificate apparently was a clerical error that no one bothered to correct. When her acting career failed to materialize, his mother went into an alcoholic decline. Gumm was 2 when Los Angeles County placed him in a foster home. At least 2 scholarly journals explained that this unhappy childhood was the reason he killed women in his basement for their skins. The words crazy and evil do not appear in either article. The film of the beauty contest that Jame Gumm watched as an adult was real footage of his mother. But the woman in the swimming pool film was not his mother, comparative measurements revealed. Gumm's grandparents retrieved him from an unsatisfactory foster home when he was 10, and he killed them 2 years later. Tulare Vocational Rehabilitation taught Gumm to be a tailor during his years at the psychiatric hospital. He demonstrated definite aptitude for the work. Gumm's employment record is broken and incomplete. Reporters found at least 2 restaurants where he worked off the books, and he worked sporadically in the clothing business. It has not been proven that he killed during this period, but Benjamin Raspail said he did. He was working at the curio store where the butterfly ornaments were made when he met Raspail, and he lived off the musician for some time. It was then that Gumm became obsessed with moths and butterflies and the changes they go through. After Raspail left him, Gumm killed Raspail's next lover, Klaus, beheaded and partially flayed him. Later he dropped in on Raspail in the East. Raspail, ever thrilled by bad boys, introduced him to Dr. Lecter. This was proven in the week after Gumm's death, when the FBI seized from Raspail's next of kin the tapes of Raspail's therapy sessions with Dr. Lecter. Years ago, when Dr. Lecter was declared insane, the therapy session tapes had been turned over to the families of the victims to be destroyed. But Raspail's wrangling relatives kept the tapes, hoping to use them to attack Raspail's will. They had lost interest listening to the early tapes, which are only Raspail's boring reminiscences of school life. After the news coverage of Jame Gumm, the Raspail family listened to the rest. When the relatives called the lawyer Everett Yao and threatened to use the tapes in a renewed assault on Raspail's will, Yao called Clarice Starling. The tapes include the final session when Lecter killed Raspail. More important, they reveal how much Raspail told Lecter about Jame Gumm. Raspail told Dr. Lecter that Gumm was obsessed with moths, that he had flayed people in the past, that he had killed Klaus, that he had a job with the Mr. Hyde Leather Goods Company in Calumet City, but was taking money from an old lady in Belvedere, Ohio, who had made linings for Mr. Hyde, Inc. One day, Gumm would take everything the old lady had, Raspail predicted. When Lecter read that the first victim was from Belvedere and she was flayed, he knew who was doing it, Crawford told Starling as they listened together to the tape. He'd have given you gum and looked like a genius if Chilton had stayed out of it. He hinted to me by writing in the file that the sites were too random, Starling said, and in Memphis he asked me if I sew. What did he want to happen?
He wanted to amuse himself, Crawford said. He's been amusing himself for a long, long time.
No tape of James Gum was ever found, and his activities in the years after Raspail's death were established piecemeal through business correspondence, gas receipts, interviews with boutique owners. When Mrs. Lipman died on a trip to Florida with Gum, he inherited everything. The old building with its living quarters and empty storefront and vast basement and a comfortable amount of money. He stopped working for Mr. Hyde, but maintained an apartment in Calumet City for a while and used the business address to receive packages in the John Grant name. He kept favored customers and continued to travel to boutiques around the country as he had for Mr. Hyde, measuring for custom garments he made in Belvedere. He used his trips to scout for victims and to dump them when they were used up, the brown van droning for hours on the interstate with finished leather garments swaying on racks in the back above the rubberized body bag on the floor. He had the wonderful freedom of the basement, room to work and play. At first it was only games, hunting young women through the Black Warren, creating amusing tableaus in remote rooms, and sealing them up, opening the doors again only to throw in a little lime. Frederica Bimmel began to help Mrs. Lipman in the last year of the old lady's life. Frederica was picking up sewing at Mrs. Lipman's when she met James Gum. Frederica Bimmel was not the first young woman he killed, but she was the first one he killed for her skin. Frederica Bimmel's letters to Gum were found among his things. Starling could hardly read the letters, because of the hope in them, because of the dreadful need in them, because of the endearments from Gum that were implied in her responses. Dearest secret friend in my breast, I love you. I didn't ever think I'd get to say that, and it is best of all to get to say it back. When did he reveal himself? Had she discovered the basement? How did her face look when he changed? How long did he keep her alive? Worst, Frederica and Gum truly were friends to the last. She wrote him a note from the pit. The tabloids changed Gum's nickname to Mr. Hyde, and, sick because they hadn't thought of the name themselves, virtually started over with the story. Safe in the heart of Quantico, Starling did not have to deal with the press, but the tabloid press dealt with her. From Dr. Frederick Chilton, the National Tatler bought the tapes of Starling's interview with Dr. Hannibal Lecter. The Tatler expanded on their conversations for their Bride of Dracula series, and implied that Starling had made frank sexual revelations to Lecter in exchange for information, spurring an offer to Starling from Velvet Talks, the Journal of Telephone Sex. People magazine did a short, pleasant item on Starling, using yearbook pictures from the University of Virginia and from the Lutheran home at Bozeman. The best picture was of the horse, Hannah, in her later years, drawing a cart full of children. Starling cut out the picture of Hannah and put it in her wallet. It was the only thing she saved. She was healing. Chapter 60. Ardelia Mapp was a great tutor. She could spot a test question in a lecture farther than a leopard can see a limp, but she was not much of a runner. She told Starling it was because she was so weighted with facts. She had fallen behind Starling on the jogging trail and caught up at the old DC-6 the FBI uses for hijack simulations. It was Sunday morning. They had been on the books for 2 days, and the pale sun felt good. "So what did Pilcher say on the phone?" Mapp said, leaning against the landing gear. "He and his sister have this place on the Chesapeake." Yeah, and? His sister's there with her kids and dogs and maybe her husband.
So?
They're in one end of the house. It's a big old dump on the water they inherited from his grandmother.
Cut to the chase!
Pilch has the other end of the house. Next weekend he wants us to go. Lots of rooms, he says. As many rooms as anybody might need. I believe is the way he put it. His sister would call and invite me, he said.
No kidding. I didn't know people did that anymore.
He did this nice scenario. No hassles, bundle up and walk on the beach, come in and there's a fire going, dogs jump all over you with their big sandy paws.
Idyllic. Mm-hmm. Big sandy paws. Go on.
It's kind of much, considering we've never had a date, even. He claims it's best to sleep with two or three big dogs when it gets really cold. He says they've got enough dogs for everybody to have a couple.
Pilcher's setting you up for the old dog suit trick. You snapped to that, didn't you?
He claims to be a good cook. His sister says he is.
Oh, she called already.
Yeah.
How'd she sound?
Okay. Sounded like she was in the other end of the house.
What did you tell her?
I said, yes, thank you very much, is what I said.
Good,
Map said.
That's very good. Eat some crabs. Grab Pilcher. Smooch him on his face. Go wild.
Chapter 61 Down the deep carpet in the corridor of the Marcus Hotel, a room service waiter trundled a cart. At the door of Suite 91, he stopped and rapped softly on the door with his gloved knuckle. He cocked his head and rapped again, to be heard above the music from within. Bach, two- and three-part inventions, Glenn Gould at the piano.
Come.
The gentleman with the bandage across his nose was in a dressing gown, writing at the desk.
Put it by the windows. May I see the wine?
The waiter brought it. The gentleman held it under the light of his desk lamp, touched the neck to his cheek.
"Open it, but leave it off the ice,"
he said, and wrote a generous tip across the bottom of the bill.
"I won't taste it now."
He did not want the waiter handing him wine to taste. He found the smell of the man's watchband objectionable. Dr. Lecter was in an excellent humor. His week had gone well. His appearance was coming right along, and as soon as a few small discolorations cleared, he could take off his bandages and pose for passport photos. The actual work he was doing himself, minor injections of silicone in his nose. The silicone gel was not a prescription item, but the hypodermics and the Novocaine were. He got around this difficulty by pinching a prescription off the counter of a busy pharmacy near the hospital. He blanked out the chicken scratches of the legitimate physician with typist's correction fluid and photocopied the blank prescription form. The first prescription he wrote was a copy of the one he stole, and he returned it to the pharmacy so nothing was missing. The palooka effect in his fine features was not pleasing, and he knew the silicone would move around if he wasn't careful, but the job would do until he got to Rio. When his hobbies began to absorb him, long before his first arrest, Dr. Lecter had made provisions for a time when he might be a fugitive. In the wall of a vacation cottage on the banks of the Susquehanna River were money and the credentials of another identity, including a passport and the cosmetic aids he'd worn in the passport photos. The passport would have expired by now, but it could be renewed very quickly. Preferring to be herded through customs with a big tour badge on his chest, he'd already signed up for a ghastly-sounding tour called South American Splendor that would take him as far as Rio. He reminded himself to write a check on the late Lloyd Wyman for the hotel bill and get the extra 5 days' lead while the check plodded through the bank, rather than sending an Amex charge into the computer. This evening he was catching up on his correspondence, which he would have to send through a remailing service in London. First he sent to Barney a generous tip and a thank-you note for his many courtesies at the asylum. Next he dropped a note to Dr. Frederick Chilton in federal protective custody, suggesting that he would be paying Dr. Chilton a visit in the near future. After this visit, he wrote, it would make sense for the hospital to tattoo feeding instructions on Chilton's forehead to save paperwork. Last, he poured himself a glass of the excellent Batard Montrachet and addressed Clarice Starling. Well, Clarice, have the lambs stopped screaming? You owe me a piece of information, you know, and that's what I'd like. An ad in the National Edition of the Times and in the International Herald Tribune on the first of any month will be fine. Better put it in the China Mail as well. I won't be surprised if the answer is yes and no. The lambs will stop for now. But, Clarice, you judge yourself with all the mercy of the dungeon scales at Thrieve. You'll have to earn it again and again, the blessed silence. Because it's the plight that drives you, seeing the plight, and the plight will not end, ever. I have no plans to call on you, Clarice, the world being more interesting with you in it. Be sure you extend me the same courtesy. Dr. Lecter touched his pen to his lips. He looked out at the night sky and smiled. I have windows. Orion is above the horizon now, and near it Jupiter, brighter than it will ever be again before the year 2000. I have no intention of telling you the time and how high it is, but I expect you can see it too. Some of our stars are the same. Clarice. Hannibal Lecter. Far to the east, on the Chesapeake shore, Orion stood high in the clear night, above a big old house, and a room where a fire is banked for the night, its light pulsing gently with the wind above the chimneys. On a large bed there are many quilts, and on the quilts and under them are several large dogs. Additional mounds beneath the covers may or may not be noble Pilcher. It is impossible to determine in the ambient light. But the face on the pillow, rosy in the firelight, is certainly that of Clarice Starling. And she sleeps deeply, sweetly, in the silence of the lambs.
The Silence of the Lambs, the 25th Anniversary Edition, was written by Thomas Harris and read by Frank Muller, with a new introduction read by Thomas Harris. The introduction was recorded in the summer of 2013 at Monk Music in East Hampton, New York. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Joanna Solitaroff. The author introduction was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. The Silence of the Lambs was produced by Recorded Books, LLC, for Simon & Schuster Audio. This has been a presentation of Recorded Books and Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.